This podcast is a TOEFOP production.
Head to TOEFOP.com for more.
The following episode of TOEFOP is rated MA for mature audiences. It may contain sexual references, time travel references, allegations of bin misconduct, and mild coarse language. TOEFOP advises that this episode is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who thinks a comedy conversation between two old mates sounds like a terrible idea for a show. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Will Anderson. Hello and thank you for watching.
And if you're watching the video of this on our Patreon, because as you all know, full videos of TOEFOP go up every week on our Patreon, you might wonder if Will and I are in quarantine. We are in separate hotel rooms on separate parts of the country doing this show. No, that is not the case. Will has been doing some gigs, and I also am doing a gig this week. I'm in WA, Will. I have not been out here for 5 years or so. Fuck, that flight is long. And it's very long with a toddler.
So how long is the flight to Western Australia? It's been so long since 4 hours?
I flew from Brisbane, five and a half hours, from Brizzy. And also, I had to drive to Brisbane first. So it was 2 hours in the car and then 5.5 hours to get to Perth. And I feel jet-lagged, like properly jet-lagged. I woke up this morning with a headache, and I think it was headache not only from just like, you know, lack of sleep and all that kind of stuff, but got to find stuff to do on that flight. So I read an entire book on the flight, but then I think having my head down like that, I mean, old man injuries are a favorite topic on Two Guys, One Cup. But I was saying, because I was complaining to Jem, I was like, oh, like behind my left eye, it's killing, and my neck's sore, and it's like,
put my neck headache out reading.
And she said, yes. And she said, oh, she's gone, yeah, I see an osteo for that. It's because she's gone, you had your head down like this, reading your Kindle on the flight over. Pressed like this point in my neck, and it was agony. Yeah. And she's like, "Oh yeah, that's exactly what happens to me."
You got to get to the osteo because you read a book.
I've read a book. Like, I thought I should be rewarded for doing something to, like, you know, expand my mind, learn about some new ideas.
Sure, because your brain filled up a little bit and got heavier.
heavier.
All that knowledge going in.
Funnily enough, it was Seth Rogen's memoir. Seth Rogen, the actor, obviously Pineapple Express guy.
Read every line as if it was said like this?
Well, I've got to admit, like, at first I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to enjoy this memoir, because he does write kind of like he talks, which is like, you know, it's sort of a lot of pop culture references and swearing, all that kind of stuff, and not necessarily like he's not like a novelist or anything like that. It's just like, it's Seth Rogen. But the amount of drug stories in this book, like, have you ever felt high just reading about someone getting high? Like, I was sort of getting like, I was riding the waves of like each story, because he tries lots of different drugs. He's a big drug advocate, but he tells this one story about being in Amsterdam on mushrooms when he's like 20 years old, having the most intense mushroom trip. And I was like getting like sympathetic kind of high off it. Like, I started feeling like I was tripping a bit, and he was talking about the sky turning purple and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh man, like I need to come down off this trip. Someone's got to bring, I need Gemma to talk me down off this book trip.
Yeah, I get that. I can never remember what the plot of the movie Garden State is, because there's a scene in that where they take ecstasy pretty early in that movie, I'm pretty sure. And I only ever get as far as that, and then I'm like, oh, now I just want to take ecstasy. Yeah. I don't want to watch this dumb movie. I want to take ecstasy.
Well, he does sort of, it's interesting, like, the amount, because, I don't know, the way he sort of structures the memoir, it sort of jumps around from him being young and, you know, then his, all these Hollywood kind of anecdotes. And I kind of thought, oh, well, all the drug stuff will be confined to when he was a younger man. But as he got more successful, the drug use seemed to kind of increase. Yeah. And not in a drug abuse kind of way. Afford more drugs and more interesting environments in which to take drugs. Like, he tells this one story about, so you know the film The Interview? Where
The North Korea.
So Yeah, that's right. And how it got banned, it got pulled from cinemas, and there was death threats. And that's what actually led to the Sony hack, is North Korea found out this film was going to come out with, you know, Kim Jong-un. And so they hacked Sony's emails, even though 6 months earlier they did a risk assessment. And this team came in and said to Sony, hey, we're seeing some rumbling about North Korea. Know you're making this film, so you should employ extra cybersecurity. So Seth Rogen and his production team, they did, and they weren't hacked. But Sony were like, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. And they were the ones.
How could anybody possibly hack our emails? And how could we have anything that's incriminating if they do?
So he tells that story, and he talks about, so it was this major kind of, you know, battle with the studio, where the studio is like, you've got to take out all Kim Jong-un references.
This movie that's about Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, and which is clearly a satire, you know, and it's a comedy. And there's the moment in which, if spoilers for the interview, there, Kim Jong-un dies at the end. And they wanted to make it as over-the-top and satirical as possible. So it's quite a graphic, like, head explosion scene where they hired, like, you know, like a Stan Winston equivalent to come in and build this lifelike replica of the actor's head and have it explode in layers, you know, skin and bone and then meat of the brain, all this kind of stuff. And the studio's like, you can't put that in. In fact, can you just instead, how about we just have like flames come across the camera so you can't sort of obscure, so you can't see what's happening. And Seth Rogen's like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, if you don't see Kim Jong-un die, does that, and the whole point of it and the reason that scene goes for 10 seconds, it's meant to be over the top and ridiculous.
Also, it literally makes the entire point that this is not a real film.
Yes.
Like, because guess what? Kim Jong-un is still alive. So, spoilers, this is not a documentary.
And he's been played by Randall Park, quite a famous American comedian. Like, I think most people will be able to make the distinction.
Hang on, sorry. My computer is telling me that it's running out of batteries.
So, for those of you watching the full video, this is Will going to get his power cable. You can see he's staying in quite a nice hotel, some modern art on the windows, a bit of light diffusion coming through there. I'm going to say he's staying in the city, I would say. Not one of the kind of like zhuzhier suburbs. I don't even know what state he's in. If I had to hazard a guess, I'd say it was perhaps Queensland.
I am in Queensland.
I don't know why. It looked like a Queensland apartment building out your window.
I am in Queensland. I've been doing shows here in Brisbane, election weekend shows. Did a show last night where I went on stage and the early polls were that the incumbents were doing quite well early on. And I went on stage with that being very much like when, you know, you go on stage or go to do something and your football team is not doing very well in the first quarter. And you're just like, this might not be good. I won't even rush to check the result. And of course, when you work in the arts, it's fair to say that a fair amount of the people who work around the arts, you know, the technicians and the people who help you put on the show, like very important people and people who, because when people talk about the arts, they always think, oh, you know, they're like, oh, fucking, I don't like that comedian, so I don't give a fuck about the arts or whatever. I don't go to plays. But like the arts aren't just the actors on stage. The arts are, or the singer on stage or whatever it might be. It's the technicians that work at the venue and the people who collect the tickets and work at the concession stores and all those sort of things. They're all employed in the arts. And so, look, there was one side of politics that doesn't give a fuck about the arts. It doesn't even have its own ministry. And there was another side that is at least more sympathetic to the arts. So around the venue with all the staff, when I went on stage, there was a real sort of, oh, fuck, this is happening again sort of vibe from everyone. Yeah. Like, no one was in a good mood. And then when I walked off stage, I was like, I'm going to go and check, like, you know, how the election's going. But I just got the sense from the way that everybody seemed to be about at least 10 centimetres taller than they were when I went on stage that things had turned around a little in the meantime. Everyone just seemed to be walking a little taller.
Well, as the votes were getting counted, the Saints were playing at the same time. And Gem and I are both working in WA this week. And so we thought, well, we'll do a family trip. We'll bring Iona, staying in a nice hotel. And last night we went out for dinner, a nice dinner. And it was meant to be like family time, but I really wanted to check the footy score. And the only way I could justify it was, oh, I'm checking the results of the election. But I would go off and watch like 5 minutes of footy and then come back and have to quickly check where the polling's at. So I come back and say, oh, yeah, looks like Labor's up. So things are all good. And then when I was going off again around about like, you know, 9:30, she's like, But they're pretty sure, like, Labour, they've got it secured. And like, no, I'm pretty sure that it's still up for grabs. I just want to make sure that...
yeah, still got to go and... I've got some interest in the teal exactly. swing, so I've just got
to
go and
well, one stage that. I had to go get nappies for Iona. We'd forgot to pack any. And so Jem had called reception, and they said, oh, well, there's a store just, you know, about 100 metres from where you're staying. You better get it there. And so I said, oh, I'll go get the nappies. It's okay. like a
yep.
three-minute walk from the hotel lobby. I made that walk last for 15 minutes. I managed to just, like, get into the lobby, sit down, watch 5 minutes, get up, walk to the store. Didn't just, like, browse the store for about 5 minutes with the phone in my hand, buy the thing, come back, stop in the lobby again, watch another 5 minutes, see the Saints finally get up. And once... That was the big relief for me. Look, I'm glad Labor's in and ScoMo's out, but knowing that the Saints had secured a victory on the road, that was a bigger win for me.
So I'm staying, you said, like, it looked like it was a nice hotel. It's kind of a hotel apartment. It's somewhere between a fancy hotel and somewhere between, like, a service department is kind of the vibe of it. And it is the Alex Perry
Hotel
and Apartments. Have you stayed here before?
Yes,
and
many times. That's where the cast of The Young Rock were staying. When I told that story about seeing all these enormous bodybuilders, that they were staying at the Alex Perry. In fact, it was all Americans when I was staying there.
It makes sense. It's kind of the sort LA. Of, if you had a big cast of people, you would definitely go, because it's got a nice vibe, but it's not like a super posh hotel. Like, you know, it's like a 4-star hotel. And, but it is quite nice. But I didn't know that I was staying here. I hadn't really checked. I just, you know, like the tour books accommodation and I, you know, stay there. I don't pay any attention. So when I got here, I was like, oh, I'm staying at the Alex Perry, like, Hotel and Apartments. Now, they're named the Alex Perry Hotel and Apartments. What would be your understanding of what do you think the involvement of Alex Perry in it? Is it just a branding thing, or would he own, like, some part of the hotel and apartments? How do you think, like, is there a chance there could be like a Will Anderson Apartments? Like, is that a deal that someone might come to me and say, hey, we think that, like, you know, there's enough people out there in the market who would, because I guess the idea is that he's had something to do with the design of it, right? Yeah.
I'd say that he probably has like a percentage share of ownership. I wouldn't say like an outright or an equal percentage, but they would say, hey, we'd like to use your brand. And then I reckon there'd be a stylistic component, which is like, can you run your eye over the design, the layout, all this kind of stuff and give your go ahead?
Well, I have, like, told the story in the podcast, I think probably more than once, you know, because it's an old story. But after the Logies 1 year, when I had, you know, gone and fucked it up and the cameras were waiting to take photos of me, I lingered in the food court a little longer so that they would clear away and I could go down and get my suitcase. And I picked up my suitcase and I took it home and it opened it up, and it turns out it wasn't actually my suitcase, that someone else had already taken my suitcase. And that person was Alex Perry. And I had Alex Perry's suitcase. And we went through Alex Perry's suitcase and took his Valium and then returned his suitcase. And I know that I've told that story publicly. And then so when I moved in here, I started worrying. I was like, imagine if he's been playing the long game. Apparently, imagine if this is the time that I get the payback, that some shit goes down at the Alex Perry Hotel.
It'd be amazing if, like, every room had an anti-Will Anderson theme to it. Yeah. Like, he knew somehow that you'd done it. And there's just like a giant mural of like your head on a pike.
Exploding.
Or something
Kim
like
Jong-un
that.
Style.
Yeah. Or just like there was Carl Barron. There's just Carl Barron and Adam Hills framed photos everywhere.
Every room. They called it the Comedy Hotel, and there was just photos of every comedian but me.
Do you remember when Sam Newman bought that place in Melbourne? I think it was on, not Beaconsfield Parade, whatever that road is that runs from Fitzroy Street through Albert Park. And it was a big Pamela Anderson face. Do you remember that? Did you ever see that house that he bought?
I remember that.
Is there been a more short-sighted design feature than plastering Pamela Anderson's face? I mean, I guess maybe, you know what? If you play the long game, it'll come round, right? She'll become kitsch, and that's like, you know, maybe not a Marilyn Monroe, but it's
well, they had the Pam and Tommy series,
which is really good. I must admit.
So, I mean, I think that Pamela Anderson now, because times have changed and there isn't really Pamela Andersons anymore, right? I kind of feel like she's a bit immortal now.
Yeah.
Because she was almost the last iconic of her type.
Yes.
Like of her
pinup.
So I think, yeah, so I think that when people like, you know, like people don't really talk about Samantha Fox because, like, you know, Pamela Anderson and people like that came after Samantha Fox. But I feel like Pamela Anderson was the last of that pinup type, and therefore there is something about her that just gets to live on because
yeah.
you're like the last version of, you know, like you can still buy, like, you know, a different version of a Mustang now, right? There's a modern version of a Mustang.
Yeah.
But when people think about the Mustang, they think about that old traditional muscle car Mustang. Like, I think that, like, Pamela Anderson is one of those iconic Mustangs.
Yes.
Like, you know, like, you just remember that era and that person, and they were so iconic of that era.
Well, I guess it's the term sex symbol, which isn't really used right. anymore. Like, if you had, like, Farrah Fawcett, if you think about what teenage boys had on their wall in throughout the decades, like, it's sort of Farrah Fawcett, maybe Brooke Shields, and then Pamela Anderson. You're right, because after that, we shifted into, like, reality. That became the kind of major entertainment currency. And so it was then like Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian and all those kind of figures. But they're not really, they're different, aren't they? Because, I mean, why are they different? But you don't, there were no posters of Paris Hilton or Kim Kardashian where you would actually get.
Well, I think also now there's so much choice to, I mean, there would have been a generation of young men who had a lot of their sexual development like shaped around Pamela Anderson, because not only was she on TV in a bikini, but she was in magazines in like revealing clothes, and like she like yeah had pinups, like literally you could buy posters of her like, you know, that like it was kind of acceptable for a teenage boy to have on their wall like a picture of Pamela Anderson. And this is all pre-internet, pre-porn. So there was this ubiquity, like in the same way as like 70 million people had watched an episode of MASH, because there wasn't streaming services and all these other things to watch. There was this idea that a whole generation of men had aspects of their sexuality framed around this one person, rather than in this day and age where that one person is probably 1,000 different people. And they're not Pamela Anderson. They're probably like Riley Reid or like some, I don't even know who, like, a popular porn star's name is to be able to name them. But like now, if you're a teenage boy, you could like have an iconic porn star that you follow on, like, you know, line rather than it being Pamela, who was just like a sexy actress. She wasn't like a porn star.
Yeah. It's, well, the media's changed, right? Like, we've gone from I guess hard, no pun intended. Like, we've gone from like physical media, magazines and so forth, to digital media. So like you wouldn't, I mean, literally there's, I have often wondered, like, do teenagers have posters on their walls anymore? Because it seems archaic. Like, I, when you go into the newsagent, are there TV hits and, like, you know, where do you get your posters from? I used to actually go to like a record store where they had like a poster section, big cardboard that you would sort through, and you could get band posters and pinups and cars or athletes, whatever you wanted. Like, I bought, because I think back to what I had on my wall as a teenager, and there was like a Michael Jordan. I think I had a Paula Abdul poster at one point, short-lived. But like I had like Jordan. Did I have other girls? I had Pearl Jam. I can't think if I had any like Pamela Anderson, but I definitely had like girls, women pinned up on the wall. But that was stuff that I had to go out and like literally buy, like proper posters. But these days, do kids even do that, or do they just project it? Is it 3D now? Are they holograms? Like, what do kids put on their walls these days?
Yeah.
Or is it naff? I
don't know. Like, nor should we know what is going on in
kids. Yeah, no. Imagine if I had like an expert, like very real detailed.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, I can tell you exactly.
Well, look, we did stay with friends on the way to WA. We stayed with friends in Brisbane on Friday night, and they've got two teenage daughters, and one of the daughters, we stayed in her bedroom. She went to the spare room, and she had nothing. She had artwork on her wall. She had like a couple of framed sort of arty photos, I think something she'd even taken. And yeah, no, there was no, you know, Hanson There was no. I was trying to think of who's like the who's a hunk from the 90s, like
Jonathan Taylor Thomas. Oh, Jonathan Taylor Thomas, JTT.
Who's probably 45 now?
I mean, it'd still be Leonardo DiCaprio, but imagine if it was just like updated Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. So it's just this like fat middle-aged man
with a beard, gross beard. Yeah, I wonder. She, I know that she, her big heartthrob, the she loves that Aussie artist. Oh, I'm going to get his name wrong. Is it Rule? Rules? Ja Rule? Not Ja Rule. I think there's an Aussie singer. He's on like Triple J all the time. I think it's Podcast Mike. Are you there? You're youth. You're young. Is there an Aussie musician called Rule?
I think it is Rule. Yeah.
Okay, good.
It's pronounced Rule. On, yeah.
Yeah. I know because. Because when she sort of started becoming, I've known these guys, they've been friends of mine for ages, and when she sort of became aware of what I did and what Gemma and I did for work, that we might have proximity to famous people, she started asking me a lot of questions about Rule. Do I know Rule?
Like, do you know Rule?
Do you know
where Rule hangs out?
Yeah, and I'm like, trust me, Rule? The famous people that I'm friends with that I know, you wouldn't want to know.
Also, none of them know who Rule is. Like, here's what I can tell you. I can ask many of my famous friends who Rule is, and they will not be able to tell me.
Who was your, like, when you were a teenager, who was, like, the person that you fantasized about most or was, like, got your heart going?
It's hard to remember, but... I think it was Winona Ryder, weirdly enough. So
yeah, what do they call the manic pixie dream girl?
I mean, look, considering like how the pattern of the rest of my life has already always turned out, I guess that probably makes a lot of sense. Turns out I was the same person at 15 as I am at fucking 48. So there you go.
I know. I was big on Winona as well. In fact, I remember going to see Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is a very like arty, sensual, almost European film. Like, there's a fair bit of boobs, and I think like Monica Bellucci plays one of the vampire demons in that. And you know, there's a lot of just. But Winona is wearing a lot of kind of like slinky. Sexy outfits. I remember there's one scene where she's running through the rain in like a sheer 90. And as like a 14-year-old or whatever I was, I remember seeing that and being like, like, and I went to...
Like, more like dick strokers. Dracula.
But I went to school and I told my mates, I was like, oh, you've got to see this new Dracula movie. Like, Winona Ryder's in it and she's in a wet t-shirt. And so I went back to see it again with my mates. So we're all expecting to see like, you know, softcore porn. They weren't prepared for a fairly cerebral, you know, erotica in a version of Bram Stoker's Dracula. And they were so mad at me. They were like, you could barely see anything. You couldn't see anything.
My dick wasn't hard for hardly any of the movie. It was just confused most of the time. Yeah, I confused my dick. For sure. Like, I think this might have been even first year uni, like, but I remember that first time I saw Reality Bites, and there's that scene of her like walking down that corridor in that sort of see-through top, and like it's like still iconically in my mind. It's like, and I remember early on where I think part of the reason that I was like I might like go into show business was there was just part of me that like had heard that Winona Ryder like dating people who were in show business, like if you're in a band or whatever, you have a chance to like date Winona Ryder. And I was like, well, if only I, because I would look at like Adam Duritz or whatever from The Counting Crows and go, he's not a good looking cat. Like, he's just good at... So, obviously, she's more, like, into what they do than what they look for. So, I thought, well, that's achievable. Maybe I could do something. And then Winona Ryder would, like, it would catch her attention. And, like, all I'm saying is, not too late. Yeah. Still could happen.
Probably better chance now than ever, really.
Yeah, right?
It is funny. I was thinking about that myself the other day about, you know, being a teenager and just, like, I wasn't very good with girls. And, you know, my way in, which hasn't changed that much, is I'd try and be funny. You know, oh, I'll charm them. I'll make them laugh. And as a teenager, that doesn't cut it. That's not what they're looking for. Like, because they have their own, you know, dreams and fantasies about the kind of boys that they want to be with and stuff. And they're not, there's no posters of, you know, like comedians on their walls. And so I couldn't understand why they'd always go for like the dickbag at my school who was like good looking and good at sport and stuff. But yeah, he wasn't funny. He didn't know the young ones off by heart. Why is she hanging out with him? But then it's like, oh yeah, of course, man. Of course they wouldn't. Like, what are you offering them that is even vaguely related to what they're interested in?
Well, but also, and vice versa. Like, you're doing the version of something that might be interesting to them in 10 years or 20 years when they, you know, like, discover that, like, somebody they can hang out with and laugh with and those sort of things is much more important than perhaps those, you know, those other superficial things. But you're also a teenager. Like, yeah. You're also, all your things are superficial things.
Yeah.
So you're not, like, if they're doing something cool, like, they've got some quirky thing or whatever. Like, I don't remember being a teenager and going, like, I'm really into Joanne because, like, she's so good at stamp collecting and I just admire her passion for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was also like, you know, there's a couple of girls that we were friends with that were dating older boys, guys who had left school, you know, maybe first, second year uni. And I was like, oh, fucking, that's, you know, those guys are gross. And what are they doing? But then you get out of high school and you look back at teenage boys and you're like, oh, fuck, no wonder. Like, if that's what you had to choose from, or a guy who could drive, maybe had a job, could take you to nice things, you know, didn't just want to talk about the young ones.
I mean, that, when I was in year 12, I went out with this, like, really lovely girl called Beth English. And she was, so we started going out when I was in year 11 and she was in year 12, I believe. And then she ended up, like, going away to uni and I was in year 12. But we were, like, dating. And it was great because she would, like, come and pick me up from school in a car and, like, all these sort of things. But I always was like, this is great for me, but what is in this for you? Like, this is your... I feel like I am not bringing much to this relationship.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because you often the reverse, you never really question it. And you think, oh, well, because girls mature faster than guys and it does sort of make a lot of sense. But then on the occasion where it's like a woman in her mid-20s and she's dating a guy who's just out of high school, you're like, this seems weird. Unless this dude is incredibly sophisticated, what's going on here?
Right.
Were you incredibly sophisticated?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I've ever been incredibly sophisticated, so it'd be surprising if I was in year 11.
You're doing your dissertation of the young ones. I'm there quoting it, but you're going, well, the interesting thing about the young ones is it's really just a deconstruction of the post-Thatcher environment for university students.
And then they're all like, you're too smart. Devolve a little bit. If you want to be relatable, you're really going to have to dumb it down a bit, mate.
Well, it's funny. Podcast Mike is my guest on FOFOP this week, and it was a very great chat. But we did talk a little bit about the new Jackass film, and I was saying to him that I love Jackass and have watched all of them. And this new one, I enjoyed. There was a lot of stuff I couldn't watch because it's just a bit too gross. I love all the kind of dumb stunts. I'm not so hot on the vomiting and the shit and all that kind of gross kind of stuff. But I do love that every time there is a new Jackass thing, there is a portion of the audience that are like, oh, it's Jackass. It's funny. I'm going to watch this. But then there is like, there's a writer for the New York Times or Rolling Stone who does this kind of Jackass, an analysis of masculinity in the 21st century. And you're like, I think you're granting it maybe a bit too much depth to it. I honestly think the guys doing Jackass know what Jackass is, but you were trying to justify why you enjoy watching Jackass.
I know what you mean. Absolutely. I do know what you mean. But I watched it, the latest one, and you know how what I'm like with vomiting and stuff like that. That is not my cup of tea at all. But I did feel like, as a piece of entertainment in the times in which we live, whether they mean it to be or not, it felt really relevant to the times. That's what I would say. I would just say, in the same way as Hannah Gadsby didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write Nanette a thing that will hit the world at the time where the world is having a conversation about the very thing that I'm having a conversation about. She didn't like plan that out. She just made a piece of art that was really important to her, and then the times just suited that piece of art. So, look, yes, I am comparing Jackass to Nanette, and this is my 1,000-word piece from the New York Times op-ed page. No, but I think that it is, like, there is something about it, because for me, I loved it. I honestly laughed so much.
Mm.
But I also think that in these times where there is so much chaos in the world in which we live, and the reaction that chaos often feels very nihilistic, and to laugh in the absurdity of life, you know, to be able to have to, that what they do on that show does feel like it is a deconstruction of that. And it also feels like the last bastions of old school masculinity and dumbness, and these things that have led to, like, that this is kind of fun and dumb, but the world has become like that, but in a serious way, you know, that our information is dumb, and that, like, dumbness is celebrated in a way that it used to be sidelined to going, this is a dumb thing. And to see those male friendships develop and people be broken down a little by life and hurt more by life, and to be able to see them try to redo something they'd been able to do in their youth and not necessarily be able to do it in the same way.
The Johnny Knoxville, like, and not to give a spoiler, the Johnny Knoxville stunt at the end, like, I was genuinely upset. Like, I just, because of his age, because of how violent it was, like, Gemma and I both were like, oh no. It was yeah, upsetting. And I was kind of like, What do you got to prove, mate? Like, you don't need to delay. I think I would have enjoyed the film just as much, but I think there was...
No, but see, that you're coming from a guy who's put his neck out reading a book. This is... You're not the guy to ask. But I agree. It feels like there is more stakes on the line.
Mm.
And so on all of those levels, I really did... Like, I agree that I don't think that the guys from Jackass get together and go, we're going to make this huge statement on the times in which we live. But... do I think that somehow they've just managed to, what they are captures a whole bunch of, like, you know, things about the world in which we live? I do think that that is the case. I don't think it's just dumb stunts. I think that there is this kind of story to it. And in fact, I enjoy it a lot more now than I did when it first came out.
Don't get me wrong. I think there's an awful lot of creativity in what they do. And obviously the minds behind it. Like, it's not just pointless. There is an element of, you know, saying something, but it's more in the same way that, like, if you look at the way modern masculinity is represented by, say, like, Joe Rogan's audience, or, you know, that sort of Rogan phenomena, and you're right, it's very self-serious. Like, it's kind of, there's an element of cruelty to it and alpha-ness to it, and if you're overweight or you're different or you're shit, then that's a flaw and you need to improve that, and you're a weak bitch and you need to work harder to improve. Whereas Jackass embraced that. If you're overweight or you're a bit slow or whatever, we love you no matter what. If you're one of us, we love you, but if you're one of us, you're going to do this dumb thing because we're all idiots in the way. And I think that, but that to me is baked into who those guys are. I don't necessarily think it's a conscious decision. They just sort of play to what that, like, I think, I can't remember if it was this show or Two Guys One Cup where we talked about male friendship. There's a large element of bullying to male friendship. Like, it's how we say we love each other, you know, it's how we bond, you know, and we all understand that when it's your turn, you're the target of the bullying. Like, that's, I was saying to Jen the other day, because she made fun of me in front of friends of ours the other day, and then I was like, oh, hey, like, you know, I don't make fun of you in the same way. Why did you make fun of me? And she's gone, because that's what you do to yourself, and I see you do with your guy friends. I'm just doing what you, and I'm like, yeah, I guess you're right. I just wasn't expecting it to come. Like, I wasn't armored and ready for it to come from you. I thought it was like, you know, I was in my safe space with you. But then to hear you make fun of me is like, but that is kind of what male friendship is. Like, there's just a large element of identifying someone's flaws, making fun of their flaws, but accepting them because of those flaws.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the greatest part of it is what you've said, is that it is really genuinely a show about people who are absolutely flawed and are almost, you know, showing off their flaws and their imperfections. Like, it, anyway, I really fucking enjoyed it, and I'm going to write an op-ed.
Have you listened to any of Steve-O's podcast, Wild Ride with Steve-O? It's really good.
No, I have not.
I mean, like, if you can get over the tone of his voice, which...
I don't think I can
be grating, but he's a really good, surprisingly good interviewer in that he doesn't put himself into the story. Like, he does occasionally will bring up our story, but he's really, really good at bringing people on. And it's an odd collection of famous people, like, not, you know, super famous people, but people who have, like, he had Corey Feldman on, and I was like, oh boy, like, I want to hear some of this stuff. And it was really interesting. He allows, like, Corey Feldman's obviously had this terrible, terrible childhood, you know, like, his parents are really awful to him, and obviously he got into drugs when he was very young, but everything that sort of happened to that happened to him after that. There is this element of I guess there was a point around about his late teens, early 20s, where he sort of detached from reality a little bit. He divorced from his parents. That ripped him off financially. He'd been exploited by managers and people who were meant to look after him. And so he did create this world for himself, you know, the Corey Feldman, where he got his angels and stuff. But then, because he created this little Kim Jong-un style oasis, there are large elements of paranoia that come with that. So he started talking about, like, oh, you know, they're sending, you know, one of the angels that they sent to my house was a spy, and she was a spy from this cabal of people who, and look, I don't know, maybe it's an element to truth of it or whatever, but there...
She wasn't one of Ian Thorpe's undercover angels.
No, she definitely wasn't an undercover angel. But Steve-O is really good at... It's not the... Like, you know, when Rogan has on, like, an Alex Jones or something, there is an element of permission to everything. Like, he's not challenged on anything. Whereas Steve-O does challenge, but not in a way that is, I'm going to humiliate you or you're wrong or whatever. It's like, okay... But if you're saying that this person was, like, I don't know, a CIA informant or whatever, then how does that track with all these things? And so you're sitting there going, is that Steve-O? Like, Steve-O being an investigative journalist here? But it's really, I would encourage you to listen to it. They're really, like, you got to, it's kind of like Joe Rogan. You got to pick the guests, because obviously some of them you're not going to gel with. But he's actually really, really good at podcasting, and it sounds like he's making a lot of money from it, which annoys me. To a certain degree. Like, how come Steve-O is making money from this thing now that he's only just adopted 2 years ago?
Well, I mean, it's good that the guy from Jackass is a better investigative journalist than the guy from Fear Factor. The world that we live in.
Yes.
See, this is what I mean, though. This is the Jackass world. I do think that, like, you know, that aspect of masculinity that is represented in Jackass, the worst aspects of it are the worst aspects of that bro culture. And the best aspects of it are the things that are compelling about that bro culture. Rogan isn't the biggest podcast in the world if there isn't something, you know, genuinely appealing and compelling about what it is he does and the club that you get to join if you're a Rogan fan. And it's only the excesses of it. I mean, did you see that interview that went around this week where he was talking about how
they're banning growing food in Australia?
Yeah. And, like... You talk about bullying and being mean. That voice he's doing when he's impersonating the person who's basically
banning food. The fictional, bureaucrat.
That they finally Google and realize it's not a real story. And so, but I was like, yeah, but you did make him sound like an idiot. You're right. That person you invented, they did sound like a real idiot when you were making him sound like an idiot.
My favorite part of that was his guest, who I'm not really sure who that guy is, but at the very end tries to bail Joe out going, like, yeah, it's fake, but it's a warning, right? It's a warning about what could happen. It's like,
No, not really. It's not. It's not a real thing.
Because a warning would suggest there was...
That people can spread misinformation. That's the only warning.
To go back to the interview, so the plot of the interview is that there's this really vain TV talk show host who, in order to boost his ratings, goes to interview Kim Jong-un. And the CIA approach him and say, hey, well, while you're there, maybe you can assassinate him because that will make the world a better place. And this talk show host goes over there. But when he meets Kim Jong-un, this, like, you know, dictator, discovers that, oh, I quite like this guy. We sort of agree on a lot of things. And then it becomes conflicted about. And so that was, you know, made in 2014, like 4 years before, well, the three, 2 years before Donald Trump got elected. And he was saying that the thing that if the film had come out in 2018, like if we'd made it after Donald Trump, because the head of Sony was this big Obama guy and was like, well, we can't release this because it's going to cause, you know, too many diplomatic issues or whatever. But if it had come out after Donald Trump had been president, it's essentially the same story, because that's what happened with Donald Trump. Donald Trump was like, little rocket boy, we're going to blow North Korea off the map. Then they have a meeting of some kind, and all of a sudden he's in love with him. He's like, we're best friends. He's writing you love letters. But the best part about that story was he said that, so the studio convinces them, look, you're going to have to cut all these scenes, and you're going to have to obscure the bit where he gets his head blown off. But when you're doing the press tour, you can't say, we made you do it. You have to say it was your idea. And so Rogan and Evan is
which is the sort of thing that you say when you're doing something like that.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to cover this up, but you definitely can't tell people that we told you to cover this up. And also, you can't tell people that we told you that you couldn't tell people to cover it up. And also, while I'm at it, you can't tell people about this conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So they agreed to it in principle. And so then he said at the premiere.
For a bit.
He went to the premiere, and halfway through the premiere, he took two MDMA capsules. And so he said he was like rolling pretty hard when the credits came up. And he said the audience seemed to enjoy it, and he went to the after party. But then something happened. Some news came out. There was like death threats, and then all these theater chains were saying, we're not going to show the film. So there's this huge disaster. And so he's like, oh, fuck this. So he went home, went to sleep. And then before he went to bed, he texted the head of the studio and was like, we've got to talk in the morning. I'm so fucking pissed off and fired up about you pulling the movie. And so he went to bed, woke up the next morning. If he was 100% high the night before, he reckons he's about 60% the next morning when he woke up. So he's like, I'll have a coffee, I'll get my head straight, I'll drive into the studio. But he said driving into the studio is getting so riled up that then the adrenaline started to make the drugs work again. So when he went into the office to confront the head of the studio, he was really high again. And so he said to them, look, all right, if you're going to pull the movie, there's no incentive for me now to cover for you. So I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, when I do the press, I'm going to say, you fucked the movie. You made us cut a bunch of stuff out. And this is not the version we wanted. And he's saying, but the whole experience is horrible and traumatic. The only thing that made it better was that he was high on MDMA.
I mean, I think that is like a fun way to live your life.
Yes.
You know, as in, when it works out.
Yes.
When it works out, that is a fun way to live your life. It is also a great fun way to end your career if it doesn't work out. And that is the risk that you're taking in those situations. But yeah, there's a few times in my life where I was like going through some shit situation where I would have been like, I should have just taken a bunch of mushrooms and come in and dealt with this today. At least it would have been a thing.
Well, that's the, I guess that's the thing about that I gleaned most from the book, is that pretty much every significant career opportunity he had was aided by or under the influence of some kind of drugs. But again, it's a question of, is he abusing them, or is it just, you know, the analogy he uses, which I thought was interesting, is that, look, you know, we used to walk around without any shoes on. Then we're like, ow, like this hurts our feet. We need to protect our feet so we can walk around more and make life easier. So we invented shoes. He's like, my brain doesn't cope in the world the way it is. I need to wrap something around my brain to make life easier so I can get through life and feel more comfortable. It doesn't affect anyone else. It doesn't hurt anyone else. So what's the problem? I was like, drugs are shoes for your brain.
Speaking my language, man. Like, that is the sort of thought you could only come up with on drugs. Hey, dude, I've got it. Drugs are shoes for your brain. Let me talk you through it. So, originally, we didn't wear shoes.
Now, Will, we're going to have to do a shorter episode this week, because you and I have places to be and things to do. I've got to get a photo in front of the Nicky Winmar statue.
I've got to do two improvised stand-up shows in a row.
So I thought I'd end with just one bit of correspondence, which is a bit long, but I think it's worthwhile to go through. They've requested complete anonymity.
Okay.
So we'll refer to this person as Listener X. Although we have referred to other listeners as Listener X. Does that make it confusing? Okay. Do you think the TOEFOP audience will confuse one Listener X for another Listener X?
Let's call them Listener X, but it's spelled EX. So just remember when we're saying it.
All right.
This is Listener X. Okay. Not an X listener, but Listener X.
This is from Listener EXX. Greetings, Will and Charlie. I stumbled across TOEFOP during the depths of the first COVID wave in the UK. As an Aussie living in London, working in the NHS, I figured it was the right demographic for Australia's number one podcast for medical professionals. I am not a doctor, but hopefully you consider an allied health professional to be a suitably qualified listener. Yes, you're in.
Absolutely, welcome. Absolutely.
Will can't clap because he's sitting on his couch.
I'm patting my chest. Like, it's kind of giving a dull thud, but I'm patting my chest at the moment.
Oh, you can hear your voice going. You're kind of doing that.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Hang on. This is for you in the NHS. There you go.
As recommended, I started with the latest episodes and worked my way back. The Bin Trilogy got me through some dark days during lockdown, and even the questionable content of the earlier shows had me chuckling on my commute. Commute. Come a communist. Well, no. What have I read? Cut to 2021, and I was unfortunately diagnosed with cancer. I was already pretty burnt out from the stress of being a frontline worker during COVID. My diagnosis was the icing on the shitty pandemic cake. During the border restrictions in Australia, it took several months for my parents to be able to fly out to come and help me. As you can imagine, it was not the best of times. In fact, it was the very worst of times. But there was some light in the darkness, and that's where you guys come in. I'm going to hold a special place in my heart for the Mr. Tickle episode for the rest of my life. That stirring rendition of a Questionable Mr. Men classic was genuinely the only thing that could make me laugh after the shock of finding out I needed chemo. Yeah, I was thinking maybe we could do a sequel to the Mr. Men. I've been reading a lot of more Mr. Men. Iona loves them. And she, oh, it's the most annoying thing. On the back of a Mr. Men book, they have all the Mr. Men's. There's like 25 of them. And she makes me go through and name what each one is. But the Mr. Strong episode, I don't know. I think Mr. Strong, like, he eats a lot of eggs. That's where he gets his power from. And I'm wondering if maybe there's some steroid abuse going on there as well.
Or at the very least, a lot of farts. Is there much talk about Mr. Strong's farting?
No, there is not. By the time I was recovering from my surgery, I had managed to convert my mum to the podcast as well. Welcome, okay. Mrs. X's mum. Mm. She's also a healthcare professional.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I should have.
Tap your chest. So it was a natural fit. We both agree that the five banter has been unparalleled. And hashtag is JOK. Charlie, please don't give up on your dream of replacing Jay for a gig. We have every faith you can get up on stage and turn 3/5 into 4. Finally, I want to leave you with a story that may provide some non-five related content.
Okay.
Recently, a friend told me about an experience one of her mates had while flat sharing. As soon as I heard the tale, I knew that I needed to hear the TOEFOP take. The subject is pasta fighting. Will, do you want to take a punt on what pasta fighting is before we get into it?
I mean, people who fight using pasta?
The story takes place at 2 a.m. on a weeknight, when the friend woke to the sound of loud clanging and thumping in their kitchen. Concerned about what was going on, she entered the room to find her flatmate had cooked large batches of spaghetti bolognese and was proceeding to throw it across the kitchen onto the walls and floor. When asked WTF was going on, the flatmate responded that she was having a bad day and needed to have a pasta fight to cool down. She was completely sober at the time and was apparently quite insistent that pasta fighting was a completely normal practice and that many people use it as a method of stress management. Comment?
Well, so far, I would think that this is just a child whose parents have played a very elaborate prank on them. Like, for 17 years, have been going, look, you're a bit angry, go into the kitchen, cook some bolognese, put some aside for mum and dad, and then just use the rest of it for a pasta fight, really chill out. And mum and dad sit on the couch, they eat some bolognese, the kid's in the kitchen, gets it out of their system with a little pasta fight. And it's at this moment they realise that this is not a thing that everybody else in the world does.
I think you're half right. I think mum and dad thought they were home alone. Mum's making a big bowl of pasta. Dad comes up behind her. They get a bit frisky. They're making loud noises. Things are clattering. The pasta goes flying. The kids walk in at the conclusion of it as mum and dad are getting dressed. And they're like, what's going on? What happened? They're like, oh, we were pasta fighting. Mum and daddy were pasta fighting.
You know what? You're 100%. That is exactly what it sounds like. Pasta fighting. Because it's not a real thing, but it would be a great cover story for, like, some in-kitchen sexual shenanigans that have been busted by the children. And you're just like, what are you guys doing in here? We were pasta fighting. You know, it's a normal thing.
In the cold light of day, the flatmate continued to maintain that pasta fighting is legit. Food wastage aside, Charlie, I'm keen to hear your thoughts on how you would have responded in this scenario. Is pasta fighting a thing? No, it's not a thing. Her parents were having sex. That is my 100% watertight conclusion. Thank you for all the laughs, boys. You've helped me through the darkest time of my life. I'm nearly at the end of the tunnel and I couldn't have done it without you. Keep up the great work. Cheers.
I do want to see the cover version. Everybody was pasta fighting. if you want to go.
listener X has signed off with J, and then in brackets, not the J, of course. Hashtag, where are you, J? J, happy to hear that you're almost through. It must be a tremendously challenging time you've been through, and I'm really glad that we could have been in some small way an assistance in you battling cancer. And please write in again and let us know how you're doing, because I would love to know. And let us know if you get into a pastor fight. In fact, maybe don't. Let us know if you get into a pastor fight. Hopefully you meet a nice man or a girl and you can pastor fight in private.
Well, here's what I would like to know. Is pastor fighting a thing? Like, I mean, can we find out?
All right.
In fact, let's just quickly, before we go, I know that we both have extra things to do, but let's just Google pastor fighting.
Okay.
And just see if anything comes up. Like, you know, because maybe we just, we're the idiots. Pastor fighting.
When your parents fuck in the kitchen.
No, it's not a thing. All the pasta fights are about cooking competitions where they're cooking pasta against each other. So if anybody out there has heard of pasta fighting, or maybe this like person has found somebody to pasta fight with themselves and has finally realized maybe that they found their lovely person and they were in the kitchen and they finally were like, I get it now.
If you want to support the show or all our shows, the best way to do that is at Patreon, tofop.com/Patreon. We put up a special bonus episode last week where we answer more of your questions. If you've got no money to give us, that's fine. You can support us just by listening to the shows. You can listen to Two Guys, One Cup on Listener. That'd be a great way to support the show, because our bosses at Listener, if they see more people signing up and listening to our show, they want to keep us on for longer, which means we get money, which means we can keep doing all the other shows that don't pay us as much. On Fofop this week, I mentioned Podcast Mike came back on. Great chat. Podcast Mike has his own podcast, 20th Century Boy, which I misnamed 21st Century Digital Boy, thinking it was the Bad Religion song, and Harry Potter and the Boys, which is, you don't have to be a Harry Potter fan to listen to that podcast. It's awesome. So, Mike, why don't you just pop on and you plug the Fofop. Did you enjoy it this week?
Yeah, had a great time chatting. We chatted a lot of different pop culture things.
Well, we did try and get talking on Jackass. I'm so glad, Will, because we tried, but you admitted straight away that you knew nothing about Jackass. So we veered off that topic. So we delve into a bit of Jackass, but I'm glad Will was able to get into a bit more in depth into Jackass.
Yeah, never seen Jackass before, but we did talk a lot about The Human Centipede, which is a fantastic... Yeah. Well, not a fantastic horror film, but a fantastic story, I guess.
Yeah. But it turns out that not only is Podcast Mike a big Harry Potter fan, he's a big Centipede fan as well. I mean, the film's not the practice.
I can't wait for his fan fiction, Harry Potter and the Human Centipede.
Oh, my God. There's a podcast.
One final adventure for Harry.
Will, you got shows to promote?
I don't, in fact. I don't think that I do. I might be all done. I'm not all done. There's going to be more shows. I am looking at some dates in Darwin and Canberra, and I'm hoping there'll be some other places as well, but none of them are locked in officially. So, no shows to promote. Oh, my television show is back in a couple of weeks, but Gruen Nation, the two episodes we did before the election, are still up on ABC iView if you want to check those out.
You should check them out. But for now... I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Will Anderson.
How long? Not long. Everyone relax.
Fucking stupid.
This podcast is a Tofop production.
Head to tofop.com for more
cool things for cool people.